Jeremy stared at his bedsheets. They were covered in writing, his own writing. It trailed across the pillow and onto the wall. There were sketches, too, scored deeply into the plaster. He found his pencil under the bed. He'd even sharpened it. In his sleep, he'd sharpened a pencil. And by the look of it, he'd been writing and drawing for hours, trying to draw a dream. With, down one side of his eiderdown, a list of parts. It had all made absolute sense when he'd seen it, like a hammer or a stick or Wheelwright's gravity escapement. It had been like meeting an old friend, and now... He stared at the scrawled lines. He'd been writing so fast he'd ignored punctuation, some of the letters too, but he could see some sense in there. He'd heard of this sort of thing. Great inventions sometimes did arise from dreams and daydreams. Didn't Hepzibah Whitlow have the idea of the adjustable pendulum clock as a result of his work as the public hangman? Didn't Wilframe Balderton always say that the idea for the fishtail escapement came after he'd eaten too much lobster? Yes, it had all been so clear in the dream. By daylight it needed a bit more work. There was a clatter of dishes from the little kitchen behind his workshop. He hurried down, dragging the sheet behind him. "I usually have," he began. "Toast, sir," said Igor, turning away from the range. "Lightly browned, I suspect."
"How did you know that?"
"An Igor learns to anticipate, sir," said Igor. "What a wonderful little kitchen, sir. I've never seen a drawer marked spoons, which just had spoons in it."
"Are you any good at working with glass, Igor?" said Jeremy, ignoring this.
"No, sir," said Igor, buttering the toast.
"You're not?"
"No, sir. I am bloody amazing at it, sir. Many of my masters have needed special apparatus not readily obtainable elsewhere, sir. What was it you wanted?"
"How would we go about building this?" Jeremy spread the sheet on the table. The slice of toast dropped from Igor's black-nailed fingers.
"Is there something wrong?" said Jeremy. "I thought someone was walking over my grave, sir," said Igor, still looking shocked.
You haven't actually ever had a grave, have you?" said Jeremy.
"Just a figure of speech, sir, just a figure of speech," said Igor, looking hurt.
"This is an idea I've had for a clock."
"The glass clock," said Igor. "Yes, I know about it. My grandfather Igor helped build the first one."
"The first one? But it's just a story for children. And I dreamed about it, and..."
"Grandfather Igor always said there was something very strange about all that," said Igor. "The explosion and everything."
"It exploded? Because of the metal spring?"
"Not exactly an explosion," said Igor. "We're no strangers to explosions, sir, us Igors. It was very odd. And we're no strangers to odd either."
"Are you telling me it really existed?" Igor seemed embarrassed about this.
"Yes," he said. "And then again, no."
"Things either exist or they don't," said Jeremy. "I am very clear about that. I have medicine."
"It existed," said Igor. "And then, after it did, it never had. This is what my grandfather told me, and he built that clock with these very hands."
Jeremy looked down. Igor's hands were gnarled, and now he came to look at them, had a lot of scar tissue around the wrists.
"We really believe in heirlooms in our family," said Igor, catching his gaze.
"Sort of hand-me-downs," said Jeremy. He wondered where his medicine was.
"Very droll, sir," said Igor. "But Grandfather Igor always said that afterwards it was like a dream, sir."
"A dream?"
"The workshop was different. The clock wasn't there. Demented Dr. Wingle, that was his master at the time,
wasn't working on the glass clock at all, but on a way of extracting sunshine from oranges. Things were different, and they always had been, sir, like it had never happened.
But it turned up in a book for children.
Yes, sir. Bit of a conundrum, sir.
Jeremy stared at the sheet with its burden of scribbles.
An accurate clock, that's all it was. A clock that would make all other clocks unnecessary, Lady Lejean has said. Building a clock like that would mean the clockmaker went down in timekeeping history. True, the book had said that time had got trapped in the clock, but Jeremy had no interest whatsoever in things that were made up. Anyway, a clock that measured. Distance didn't get tangled up in a tape measure. All a clock did was count teeth on a wheel, or light. Light with teeth. He'd seen that in a dream. Light not as something bright in the sky, but as an excited line going up and down like a wave.
"Could you build something like this?" he said. Igor looked at the drawings again.
"Yes," he said, nodding.
Then he pointed to several large glass containers around the drawing of the central column of the clock.
"And I know what these are," he said.
"In my... I mean, I imagined them as fizzing," said Jeremy.
"Very, very secret knowledge, those jars," said Igor, carefully ignoring the question. "Can you get copper rods here, sir?"
"In Ankh-Morpork, easily."
"And zinc?"
"Lots of it, yes."
"Sulfuric acid?"
"By the carboy, yes."
"I must have died and gone to heaven," said Igor. "Just put me near enough copper and zinc and acid, sir," he said, "and then we shall see sparks."
"My name," said Lute Say, leaning on his broom as the irate Ting raised a hand, "is Lute Say."
The dojo went silent. The attacker paused in mid-bellow.
Oh, shit!
The man did not move, but seemed instead to turn in on himself, sagging from the martial stance into a kind of horrified, penitent crouch. Lute Say bent over and struck a match on his unprotesting chin.
"What's your name, lad?"
he said, lighting his ragged cigarette.
"His name is Mud, Lute Say,"
said the dojo master, striding forward. He gave the unmoving challenger a kick.
"Well, Mud, you know the rules. Face the man you have challenged, or give up the belt."
The figure remained very still for a moment, and then, cautiously, in a manner almost theatrically designed not to give offence, started to fumble with his belt.
"No, no, we don't need that," said Lutze kindly. "It was a good challenge, a decent eye, and a very passable high E, I thought. Good martial gibberish all round, such as you don't often hear these days. And we would not want his trousers falling down at a time like this, would we?"
He sniffed and added,
"Especially at a time like this."
He patted the shrinking man on the shoulder.
"Just you recall the rule your teacher here taught you on day one, eh? And why don't you go and clean yourself up? I mean, some of us have to tidy up in here."
Then he turned and nodded to the dojo master.
"While I am here, master, I should like to show young Lobsang the device of erratic balls."
The dojo master bowed deeply.
"It is yours, Lute Say the sweeper."
As Lobsang followed the ambling Lute Say, he heard the dojo master, who, like all teachers, never missed an opportunity to drive home a lesson, say,
"Dojo, what is rule one?"
Even the cowering challenger mumbled along to the chorus,
"Do not act incautiously when confronting little, bald, wrinkly, smiling men."
"Good rule, Rule One," said Lutze, leading his new acolyte into the next room. "I have met many people who could have aided it to good advantage."
He stopped, without looking at Lobsang Lud, and held out his hand.
"And now, if you please, you will return the little shovel you stole from my pocket when we first met."
"But I came nowhere near you, master."
Lutze's smile did not flicker.
"Oh, yes, that is true. My apologies. The ramblings of an old man. "Is it not written, 'I'd forget my own head if it wasn't nailed on'? Let us proceed."
The floor in here was wood, but the walls were high and padded. There were reddish-brown stains here and there.
"We have one of these in the novice's dojo, sweeper," said Lobsang.
"But the balls in that are made of soft leather, yes?"
said the old man, approaching a tall wooden cube. A row of holes ran halfway up the side that faced down the length of the room.
"And they travel quite slowly, I recall."
Yes, said Lobsang, watching him pull on a very large lever.
Down below there was the sound of metal on metal, and then of urgent gushing water. Air began to wheeze from joints in the box.
"These are wooden," said Lutze calmly. "Catch one."
Something touched Lobsang's ear, and behind him the padding shook as a ball buried itself deeply and then dropped to the floor.
"Perhaps a shade slower," said Lutze, turning a knob.
After 15 random balls, Lobsang caught one in his stomach. Lutze sighed and pushed the big lever back.
"Well done," he said.
"Sweeper, I'm not used to," said the boy, picking himself up.
"Oh, I knew you couldn't catch one," said Lutze. "Even our boisterous friend out there in the dojo wouldn't catch one at that speed."
"But you said you had slowed it down."
"Only so that it wouldn't kill you. Just a test, see? Everything's a test. Let's go, lad. Can't keep the abbot waiting."
Trailing cigarette smoke, Lutze ambled away. Lobsang followed, getting more and more nervous. This was Lutze the dojo had proved at, and he knew it anyway. He'd looked at the little round face as it gazed amicably at the angry fighter and known it. But just a sweeper? No insignia, no status? Well, obviously status, because the dojo master couldn't have bowed lower for the abbot, but... And now he was following the man along passages where even a monk was not allowed to go on pain of death. Sooner or later there was surely going to be trouble.
"Sweeper, I really ought to be back at my duties in the kitchens," he began.
"Oh, yes, kitchen duties," said Lutze. "To teach you the virtues of obedience and hard work, right?"
"Yes, sweeper."
"Are they working?"
"Oh, yes."
"Really?"
"Well, no."
"They're not all there cracked up to be, I have to tell you," said Lutze. "Whereas, my lad, what we have here," he stepped through an archway, "is an education."
It was the biggest room Lobsang had ever seen. Shafts of light speared down from glazed holes in the roof, and below, more than 100 yards across, and tended by senior monks who walked above it on delicate wire walkways, Lobsang had heard about the mandala. It was as if someone had taken tons of coloured sands and thrown them across the floor in a great swirl of coloured chaos. But there was order fighting for survival in the chaos, rising and falling and spreading. Millions of randomly tumbling sand grains would nevertheless make a piece of pattern, which would replicate and spread across the circle, rebounding or merging with other patterns, and eventually dissolving into the general disorder. It happened again and again, turning the mandala into a silent raging war of colour. Lutze stepped out onto a frail-looking wood and rope bridge.
"Well," he said, "what do you think?"
Lobsang took a deep breath. He felt that if he fell off the bridge, he'd drop into the surging colours and never, ever hit the floor. He blinked and rubbed his forehead. "It's evil," he said.
"Really?" said Lutze. "Not many people say that the first time. They use words like wonderful."
"It's going wrong."
"What?"
Lobsang clutched the rope railing.
"The patterns," he began. "History repeating," said Lutze. "They're always there."
"No, they're..." Lobsang tried to take it all in. "There were patterns under the pattern, disguised as part of the chaos. I mean, the other patterns." He slumped forward. The air was cold, the world was spinning, and the ground rushed up to enfold him, and stopped a few inches away. The air around him sizzled, as though it was being gently fried.
"Newgate, lad!"
Lutse, he said, the mandala is...
But where were the colours? Why was the air wet and smelling of the city? And then the ghost memories faded away. As they disappeared, they said, how can we be memories when we have yet to happen? Surely what you remember is climbing all the way up onto the roof of the Baker's Guild and finding that someone had loosened all the capping stones, because that just happened. The last dying memory said, hey, that was months ago.
No, we're not Lutse, mysterious falling kid, said the voice that had addressed him. Can you turn round?
Newgate managed with great difficulty to move his head. It felt as though he was stuck in tar. A heavy young man in a grubby yellow robe was sitting on an upturned box a few feet away. He looked a bit like a monk, except for his hair, because his hair looked a bit like an entirely separate organism. To say that it was black and bound up in a ponytail is to miss the opportunity of using the term elephantine. It was hair with personality.
"Mostly, my name's Soto," said the man underneath. "Marco Soto. I won't bother memorizing yours until we know if you're going to live or not, eh? So, tell me, have you ever considered the rewards of the spiritual life?"
"Right now, certainly," said... "Yes, Newgate," he thought. "That's my name, yes. So why do I remember Lobsang?"
"I was thinking about the possibility of taking up a new line of work."
"Good career move," said Soto.
"Is this some kind of magic?"
Newgate tried to move, but hung, turning gently in the air just above the waiting ground.
"Not exactly. You seem to have shaped time."
"Me? How did I do that?"
"You don't know?"
"No."
"Ha! Well, you listen to him,"
said Soto, as if talking to a genial companion.
"There's probably the spin time of a whole procrastinator being used up to prevent your little trick causing untold harm to the entire world, and you don't know how you did it?"
"No."
"Then we'll train you. It's a good life and offers excellent prospects. At least," he added, sniffing, "better than those that confront you now."
Newgate strained to turn his head further.
"Train me in what exactly?"
The man sighed.
"Still asking questions, kid. Are you coming or not?"
"How?
Look, I'm offering you the opportunity of a lifetime. Do you understand?"
"Why is it the opportunity of a lifetime, Mr. Soto?"
"No, you misunderstand me. You, that is Newgate Ludd, are being offered, that is by me, the opportunity of having a lifetime, which is more than you will have shortly."
Newgate hesitated. He was aware of a tingling in his body. In a sense, it was still falling. He didn't know how he knew this, but the knowledge was as real as the cobbles just below him. If he made the wrong choice, the fall would simply continue. It had been easy so far. The last few inches would be terminally hard. "I must admit I don't like the way my life is going at the moment," he said. "It may be advantageous to find a new direction."
"God!"
The behaired man pulled something out of his robe. It looked like a folded abacus, but when he opened it up, parts of it vanished with little flashes of light, as if they'd moved somewhere where they could not be seen.
"What are you doing?" "Do you know what kinetic energy is?"
"No."
"It's what you have far too much of."
Soto's fingers danced on the beads, sometimes disappearing and reappearing.
"I imagine you weigh about 110 pounds, yes?"
He pocketed the little device and strolled off to a nearby cart. He did something that Newgate couldn't see and came back.
"In a few seconds you will complete your fall," he said,
reaching under him to place something on the ground.
"Try to think of it as a new start in life."
Newgate fell. He hit the ground. The air flashed purple, and the laden cart across the street jerked a foot into the air and collapsed heavily. One wheel bounced away. Soto leaned down and shook Newgate's unresisting hand.
"How do you do?" he said. "Any bruises?"
"It does hurt a bit," said the shaken Newgate.
"Maybe you're a bit heavier than you look. Allow me."
Soto grabbed Newgate under the shoulders and began to tug him off into the mists.
"Can I go and—"
"No.
But the guild "You don't exist at the Guild."
"That's stupid. I'm in the Guild records."
"No, you're not. We'll see to that."
"How? You can't rewrite history."
"Bet you a dollar."
"What have I joined?"
"We're the most secret society that you can imagine."
"Really? Who are you, then?"
"The Monks of History."
"Huh? I've never heard of you."
"See? That's how good we are."
And that was how good they were. And then the time had just flown past. And now the present came back.
"Are you all right, lad?"
Lobsang opened his eyes. His arm felt as though it was being wrenched out of his body. He looked up along the length of the arm to Lutse, who was lying flat on the swaying bridge, holding him.
"What happened?" "I think maybe you were overcome with the excitement, lad, or vertigo, maybe. Just don't look down."
There was a roaring below Lobsang, like a swarm of very angry bees. Automatically, he began to turn his head.
"I said don't look down, just relax."
Lutse got to his feet. He raised Lobsang at arm's length, as though he were a feather, until the boy's sandals were over the wood of the bridge. Below, monks were running along the walkways and shouting.
"Now, keep your eyes shut, don't look down, and I'll just walk us both to the far side, all right?"
I remembered, back in the city when Soto found me. I remembered," said Lobsang weakly, tottering along behind the monk.
"Only to be expected," said Lutse, "in the circumstances."
But I remember that back then I remembered about being here, you and the mandala."
"Is it not written in the sacred text? There's a lot goes on we don't know about, in my opinion," said Lutse.
"I have not yet come across that one either, sweeper," said Lobsang.
He felt cooler air around him, which suggested they had reached the rock tunnel on the far side of the room.
"Sadly, in the writings they have here, you probably won't," said Lutse. "Ah, you can open your eyes now."
They walked on, with Lobsang rubbing his head to take away the strangeness of his thoughts. Behind them, the livid swirls in the wheel of colour, which had centred on the spot where Lobsang would have fallen, gradually faded and healed. According to the first scroll of When the Eternally Surprised, Wen and Clodpool reached the green valley between the towering mountains, and Wen said, "This is the place. Here there will be a temple dedicated to the folding and unfolding of time. I can see it."
"I can't, master," said Clodpool.
Wen said, "It's over there." He pointed, and his arm vanished.
"Ah," said Clodpool, "over there."
A few cherry blossom petals drifted down onto Wen's head from one of the trees that grew wild along the streamlets.
"And this perfect day will last for ever," he said. "The air is crisp, the sun is bright, there is ice in the streams. Every day in this valley will be this perfect day."
"Could get a bit repetitive, master," said Clodpool.
"That is because you don't yet know how to deal with time," said Wen. "But I will teach you to deal with time as you would deal with a coat, to be worn when necessary and discarded when not."
"Will I have to wash it?" said Clodpool.
Wen gave him a long, slow look.
"That was either a very complex piece of thinking on your part, Clodpool, or you are just trying to overextend a metaphor in a rather stupid way. Which do you think it was?"
Clodpool looked at his feet. Then he looked at the sky. Then he looked at Wen.
"I think I am stupid, master."
"Good," said Wen.
"It is fortuitous that you are my apprentice at this time. Because if I can teach you, Clodpool, I can teach anyone."
Clodpool looked relieved and bowed.
"You do me too much honour, master." "And there is a second part to my plan," said Wen.
"Ah,"
said Clodpool, with an expression that he thought made him look wise, although in reality it made him look like someone remembering a painful bowel movement.
"A plan with a second part is always a good plan, master."
Find me sands of all colours and a flat rock. I will show you a way to make the currents of time visible.
All right.
And there is a third part to my plan.
A third part, eh?
I can teach a gifted few to control their time, to slow it and speed it up, and store it and direct it like the water in these streams. But most people will not, I fear, let themselves become able to do this. We have to help them. We will have to build devices that will store and release time to where it is needed, because men cannot progress if they are carried like leaves on a stream. People need to be able to waste time, make time, lose time, and buy time. This will be our major task.
Claude Poole's face twisted with the effort of understanding. Then he slowly raised a hand. Wen sighed.
"You're going to ask what happened to the coat, aren't you?" he said.
Claude Poole nodded.
"Forget about the coat, Claude Poole. The coat is not important. Just remember that you are the blank paper on which I will write."
Wen held up a hand as Claude Poole opened his mouth.
"Just another metaphor. Just another metaphor. And now, please make some lunch."
"Metaphorically or really, Master?"
"Both."
A flight of white birds burst out of the trees and wheeled overhead before swooping off across the valley.
"There will be doves," said Wen, as Claude Poole hurried off to light a fire. "Every day there will be doves."
Lutse left the novice in the anteroom. It might have surprised those who disliked him that he took a moment to straighten his robe before he entered the presence of the abbot, but Lutse at least cared for people, even if he did not care for rules. He pinched out his cigarette and stuck it behind his ear too. He had known the abbot for almost 600 years and respected him. There weren't many people Lutse respected. Mostly they just got tolerated. Usually the sweeper got on with people in inverse proportion to their local importance, and the reverse was true. The senior monks... well, there could be no such thing as bad thoughts amongst people so enlightened, but it is true that the sight of Lutse ambling insolently through the temple did tarnish a few karmas. To a certain type of thinker, the sweeper was a personal insult, with his lack of any formal education or official status, and his silly little way and his incredible successes. So it was surprising that the abbot liked him, because never had there been an inhabitant of the valley so unlike the sweeper, so learned, so impractical and so frail. But then, surprise is the nature of the universe. Lutse nodded to the minor acolytes who opened the big varnished doors.
"How is his reverence today?"
he said.
"The teeth are still giving him trouble, O Lutse, but he is maintaining continuity and has just taken his first steps in a very satisfactory manner." "Yes, I thought I heard the gongs."
The group of monks, clustered in the centre of the room, stepped aside as Lutse approached the playpen. It was unfortunately necessary. The abbot had never mastered the art of circular ageing. He had, therefore, been forced to achieve longevity in a more traditional way, via serial reincarnation.
"Ah, sweeper," he burbled,
awkwardly tossing aside a yellow ball and brightening up.
"And how are the mountains? Wanna biki, wanna biki?" "I'm definitely getting volcanism, Reverend One. It's very encouraging."
"And you are in persistent good health?"
said the abbot, while his pudgy little hand banged a wooden giraffe against the bars.
"Yes, Your Reverence, it's good to see you up and about again."
"Only for a few steps so far, alas.
Bikit, bikit, what a bikit!
Unfortunately, young bodies have a mind of their own.
Bikit!" "You sent me a message, Your Reverence. It said, put this one to the test."
"And what did you think of our...
want bikit, want bikit, want bikit now!"
"Young Lobsang Lud."
An acolyte hurried forward with a plate of rusks.
"'Would you care for a rusk, by the way?' the abbot added.
"'Nicey, Bicket!'
"'No, Reverend One, I have all the teeth I need,' said the sweeper. "'Lud is a puzzle, is he not? "'His tutors have Nicey Bicket. Bicket told me he is very talented, but somehow not all there. "'But you have never met him, and don't know his history, and so, Bicket, "'and so I would value your uninfluenced observations, Bicket!'
"'He is beyond fast,' said Lutze. "'I think he may begin to react to things before they happen.'
"'How can anyone tell that? "'Want Teddy, want Teddy, want one or one a Teddy?'
"'I put him in front of the device of erratic balls in the senior dojo, "'and he was moving towards the right hole fractionally before the ball came out.
"'Some kind of telepathy, then?'
"'If a simple machine has a mind of its own, I think we're in really big trouble.' said Lutze.
He took a deep breath. And in the Hall of the Mandala he saw the patterns in the chaos.
"'You'll let a neophyte see the Mandala?' said Chief Acolyte Rinpo, horrified.
"'If you want to see if someone can swim, push him in the river,' said Lutze, shrugging. "'What other way is there?'
"'But to look at it without the proper training.'
"'He saw the patterns,' said Lutze. "'And reacted to the mandala.'
"'He did not add, and the mandala reacted to him. "'He wanted to think about that. "'When you look into the abyss, it's not supposed to wave back.
"'It was Teddy, 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 wah!
"'Strictly forbidden even so,' said the abbot. "'Clumsily he fumbled amongst the toys on his mat "'and picked up a large wooden brick with a jolly blue elephant printed on it "'and hurled it clumsily at Rinpo.'
"'Sometimes you presume too much, sweeper. Look at elephant!'
There was some applause from the acolytes at the abbot's prowess in animal recognition.
"'He saw the patterns. He knows what is happening. He just doesn't know what he knows,' said Lutze doggedly. "'And within a few seconds of meeting me, he stole a small object of value, and I'm still wondering how he did it.' Can he really be as fast as that without training? Who is this boy?
Who is this girl? Madame Frout, headmistress of the Frout Academy and pioneer of the Frout method of learning through fun, often found herself thinking that when she had to interview Miss Susan. Of course the girl was an employee, but... Well, Madame Frout wasn't very good at discipline, which was possibly why she'd invented the method, which didn't require any. She generally relied on talking to people in a jolly tone of voice until they gave in out of sheer embarrassment on her behalf. Miss Susan didn't appear ever to be embarrassed about anything.
"'The reason I've called you here, Susan, is that, the reason is—'
Madame Frout faltered.
"'There have been complaints,' said Miss Susan.
No, although Miss Smith has told me that the children coming up from your class are, restless. Their reading ability is, she says, rather unfortunately advanced.
Miss Smith thinks a good book is about a boy and his dog chasing a big red ball, said Miss Susan. My children have learned to expect a plot. No wonder they get impatient. We're reading grim fairy tales at the moment.
"'That is rather rude of you, Susan.'
"'No, madam, that is rather polite of me. "'It would have been rude of me to say that there is a circle of hell "'reserved for teachers like Miss Smith.'
"'But that's a dreadful—'
"'Madam Frout stopped and began again.
"'You should not be teaching them to read at all yet,'
she snapped. "'But it was the snap of a soggy twig. "'Madam Frout cringed back in her chair when Miss Susan looked up. "'The girl had this— terrible ability to give you her full attention. You had to be a better person than Madame Frout to survive in the intensity of that attention. It inspected your soul, putting little red circles around the bits it didn't like. When Miss Susan looked at you, it was as if she was giving you marks.
"'I mean,' the headmistress mumbled, "'a childhood is a time for play and learning,' said Miss Susan. "'Learning through play!'
said Madame Frout, grateful to find familiar territory. After all, at kittens and puppies grow up to be cats and dogs, which are even less interesting, said Miss Susan, whereas children should grow up to be adults. Madame Frout sighed. There was no way she was going to make any progress. It was always like this. She knew she was powerless. News about Miss Susan had got around. Worried parents, who turned to learning through play because they despaired of their offspring ever learning by paying attention to what anyone said, were finding them coming home a little quieter, a little more thoughtful, and with a pile of homework which, amazingly, they did without prompting, and even with the dog helping them. And they came home with stories about Miss Susan. Miss Susan spoke all languages. Miss Susan knew everything about everything. Miss Susan had wonderful ideas for school trips. And that was particularly puzzling because, as far as Madame Frout knew, none had been officially organized. There was invariably a busy silence from Miss Susan's classroom when she went past. This annoyed her. It harked back to the bad old days when children were regimented in classrooms that were no better than torture chambers for little minds. But other teachers said that there were noises. Sometimes there was the faint sound of waves, or a jungle. Just once Madame Frout could have sworn, if she was the sort to swear, that as she passed there was a full-scale battle going on. This had often been the case with learning through play, but this time the addition of trumpets, the swish of arrows, and the screams of the fallen seemed to be going too far. She'd thrown open the door, and felt something hiss through the air above her head. Miss Susan had been sitting on a stool, reading from a book, with the class cross-legged in a quiet and fascinated semicircle around her. It was the sort of old-fashioned image that Madame Frout hated, as if the children were supplicants around some sort of altar of knowledge. No one had said anything. All the watching children and Miss Susan made it clear in polite silence that they were waiting for her to go away. She'd flounced back into the corridor, and the door had clicked shut behind her. But then she noticed the long, crude arrow that was still vibrating in the opposite wall of the corridor. Madame Frout had looked at the door, with its familiar green paint, and then back at the arrow, which had gone. She transferred Jason to Miss Susan's class. It had been a cruel thing to do, but Madame Frout considered that there was now some kind of undeclared war going on. If children were weapons, Jason would have been banned by international treaty. Jason had doting parents and an attention span of minus several seconds, except when it came to inventive cruelty to small furry animals, when he could be quite patient. Jason kicked, punched, bit and spat. His artwork had even frightened the life out of Miss Smith, who could generally find something nice to say about any child. He was definitely a boy with special needs. In the view of the staff room, these began with an exorcism. Madame Frout had stooped to listening at the keyhole. She had heard Jason's first tantrum of the day, and then silence. She couldn't quite make out what Miss Susan said next. When she found an excuse to venture into the classroom half an hour later, Jason was helping two little girls to make a cardboard rabbit. Later, his parents said they were amazed at the change, although apparently now he would only go to sleep with the light on. Madame Frout tried to question her newest teacher. After all, glowing references were all very well, but she was an employee, after all. The trouble was, Susan had a way of saying things to her, Madame Frout had found, so that she went away feeling quite satisfied, and only realized that she hadn't really had a proper answer at all when she was back in her office, by which time it was always too late. And it continued to be too late, because suddenly the school had a waiting list. Parents were fighting to get their children enrolled in Miss Susan's class. As for some of the stories they had brought home, well, everyone knew children had such vivid imaginations, didn't they? Even so, there was this essay by Richenda Higgs. Madame Frout fumbled for her glasses, which she was too vain to wear all the time and kept on a string around her neck, and looked at it again. In its entirety, it read, "A man with all bones came to talk to us. He was not scary at all. He had a big white horse. We painted the horse.
He had a scythe. He told us interesting things and to be careful when crossing the road.
Madame Frout handed the paper across the desk to Miss Susan, who looked at it gravely. She pulled out a red pencil, made a few little alterations, then handed it back.
"Well?" said Madame Frout.
"Yes, she's not very good at punctuation, I'm afraid. A good attempt at scythe, though."
"Who? What's this about a big white horse in the classroom?" Madame Frout managed.
Miss Susan looked at her pityingly and said,
"Madam, who could possibly bring a horse into a classroom? We're up two flights of stairs here."
Madame Frout was not going to be deterred this time. She held up another short essay.
"Today we were talked at by Mr. Slumph, who he is a bogeyman, but he is nice now. He told us what to do about the other kind. You can put the blanket over your head, but it is better if you put it over the bogeyman's head, then he think he do not exist and he is vanishes. He told us lots of stores about people he jump out on, and he said, since Miss is our teacher, he think no bogeymen will be in our houses, because one thing a bogey does not like is Miss finding him."
"Bogeymen, Susan?" said Madame Frat.
"What imaginations children have," said Miss Susan with a straight face.
"Are you introducing young children to the occult?" said Madame Frout suspiciously. This sort of thing caused a lot of trouble with parents, she was well aware.
"Oh, yes."
"What? Why?"
"So that it doesn't come as a shock," said Miss Susan calmly.
"But Mrs. Robertson told me that her Emma was going around the house looking for monsters in the cupboards. And up until now, she's always been afraid of them."
"Did she have a stick?" said Susan.
"She got her father's sword.
Good for her."
"Look, Susan, I think I see what you're trying to do," said Madame Frout, who didn't really. "But parents do not understand this sort of thing."
"Yes," said Miss Susan. "Sometimes I really think people ought to have to pass a proper exam before they're allowed to be parents. Not just the practical, I mean."
"Nevertheless, we must respect their views," said Madame Frout, but rather weakly, because occasionally she thought the same thing.
There had been the matter of parents' evening. Madame had been too tense to pay much attention to what her newest teacher was doing. All she'd been aware of was Miss Susan sitting and talking quietly to the couples, right up to the point where Jason's mother had picked up her chair and chased Jason's father out of the room. Next day, a huge bunch of flowers had arrived for Susan from Jason's mother, and an even bigger bunch from Jason's father. Quite a few other couples had also come away from Miss Susan's desk looking worried or harassed. Certainly Madame Frout, when the time came for next term's fees to be paid, had never known people cough up so readily. And there it was again. Madame Frout, the headmistress, who had to worry about reputations and costs and fees, just occasionally heard the distant voice of Miss Frout, who had been quite a good, if rather shy, teacher, and it was whistling and cheering Susan on. Susan looked concerned. "You are not satisfied with my work, madam?" Madame Frout was stuck. No, she wasn't satisfied, but for all the wrong reasons. And it was dawning on her, as this interview progressed, that she didn't dare sack Miss Susan, or worse, let her leave of her own accord. If she set up a school and news got round, the learning-through-play school would simply hemorrhage pupils, and, importantly, fees.
"Well, of course, and in many ways," she began, and became aware that Miss Susan was staring past her.
There was... Madame Frout groped for her glasses and found their string had got tangled with the buttons of her blouse. She peered at the mantelpiece and tried to make sense of the blur.
"Why, it looks like a white rat in a little black robe," she said, "and walking on its hind legs, too. Can you see it?"
"I can't imagine how a rat would wear a robe," said Miss Susan. Then she sighed and snapped her fingers. The finger-snapping wasn't essential, but time stopped. At least, it stopped for everyone but Miss Susan, and for the rat on the mantelpiece, which was in fact the skeleton of a rat, although this was not preventing it from trying to steal Madame Frout's jar of boiled sweets for good children.
Susan strode over and grasped the collar of the tiny robe.
"Squeak!" said the Death of Rats.
"I thought it was you," snapped Susan. "How dare you come here again? I thought you'd got the message the other day. And don't think I didn't see you when you turned up to collect Henry the Hamster last month. Do you know how hard it is to teach geography when you can see someone kicking the poo out of a treadmill?"
The Rat sniggered.
"And you're eating a sweet. Put it in the bin right now."
Susan dropped the Rat onto the desk in front of the temporarily frozen Madame Frout and paused. She'd always tried to be good about this sort of thing, but sometimes you just had to acknowledge who you were. So she pulled open the bottom drawer to check the level in the bottle that was Madame's shield and comforter in the wonderful world that was education, and was pleased to see that the old girl was going a bit easier on the stuff these days. Most people have some means of filling up the gap between perception and reality, and, after all, in those circumstances there are far worse things than gin. She also spent a little while going through Madame's private papers, and this has to be said about Susan. It did not occur to her that there was anything wrong about this, although she'd quite understand that it was probably wrong if you weren't Susan Stowe Hellet, of course. The papers were in quite a good safe that would have occupied a competent thief for at least 20 minutes. The fact that the door swung open at her touch suggested that special rules applied here. No door was closed to Miss Susan. It ran in the family. Some genetics are passed on via the soul. When she'd brought herself up to date on the school's affairs, mostly to indicate to the Rat that she wasn't just someone who could be summoned at a moment's notice, she stood up. "All right," she said wearily. "You're just going to pester me, aren't you, for ever and ever and ever?" The Death of Rats looked at her with its skull on one side.
"Squeak," it said winsomely.
"Well, yes, I like him," she said, "in a way. But I mean, you know, it's not right. Why does he need me? He's Death. He's not exactly powerless. I'm just human."
The Rat squeaked again, jumped down onto the floor, and ran through the closed door. It reappeared for a moment and beckoned to her.
"Oh, all right," said Susan to herself. "Make that mostly human."
Tick.